none of your business actually to I do see. Anything with about someone who is sleeping. Of course, mm-hmm. everybody has to fulfill his own duty. Okay, as long as you know that it's makruh for you.
Yes.
Okay, for you to talk about worldly affairs and to sleep in a mosque and a place which is actually dedicated for prayers.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously engaging in something which is opposed to the very concept of the mosque, because a mosque is a place where one should do zikr of Allah, when one should remember God, and if anything runs against that goal, then that can be either haram or makruh.
I see. Thank you very much, Tawid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back continuing our discussion about the laws of mosque according to Ayatollah Sistani's fatwas. Stay with us.
The office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, and my guest speaker, as always, Sheikh Tawid. Sheikh Tawid, you were talking about the reprehensible things and acts that are better to be avoided about a mosque. Is there anything left?
No, actually, of course, there could be many different things which are maybe makruh or reprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I would like to ask our audience to refer to the Risala or to the Manual of Islamic Laws written by Ayatollah Sistani to learn more about makruh things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And of course, the makruh things have been discussed in more detailed books, which may not be part of the Risala, because
yes.
the Risala is supposed to be very brief, very, very short, and very concise. And if it's going to, if it were long, then people would find it very much boring. So, in the you can find it in more demonstrative books, and but of course, it's not necessary.
Uh-huh, I see. There was this two-story mosque, for example, in a neighborhood. But when it was first built, there was only one floor, one story to it. Okay.
Yeah.
Should the second floor also be treated as the first floor, especially when it comes to menstruating ladies entering it or staying there?
Yeah. Ayatollah Sistani says that, of course, Grand Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that the second floor is also a part of the mosque. Therefore, all the rules which apply to the first floor of the mosque will also definitely apply to the second floor.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to menstruating women, it's not permissible for those women to pause there, to stay there in that mosque. Of course, they can enter from one door and leave the mosque from another door without
mm-hmm.
having to stay there, without
yes.
staying there, without halting there, without leaving anything there
mm-hmm.
or picking up anything from that
yes.
from that place. So the rules of the mosque will definitely apply to that second floor as well.
I see. Sheikh Tawid, is it haram or ritually unlawful, according to Ayatollah Sistani's jurisprudence, for ladies to enter and stay in a local mosque? Which mosques are haram for menstruating ladies to enter?
We know and we do know that there are some very important mosques which are sacred for all Muslims around the world. The most important mosques are Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi, of course. It is absolutely forbidden for a menstruating woman to enter these mosques, these two mosques, Masjid al-Haram. And even entering is forbidden. Of course, we do know that Masjid al-Haram has many doors. Masjid al-Nabi has also got many doors. But even then, it's not permissible for a woman to walk through the mosque and leave the mosque from another, these two mosques. But of course, when it comes to local mosques or Masjid Jame, central mosque, or the mosques we go usually to, of course, it is permissible for a menstruating woman to enter that mosque from one door and to quickly leave the same mosque from another door, not from the same door, okay? She can walk through the mosque and leave the mosque from another door. So there are certain things for a mosque, for a ministrating woman to do when in connection with entering the mosque. A ministrating woman cannot halt in the local mosque, okay?
Yes.
She cannot pause there, and she cannot leave an article, something in that mosque, and she cannot, of course, you know, she cannot, let's say, pause there or pick something from that mosque, you know. Obviously, there are many other things which are haram, because when a woman in a menstruating, who is menstruating, enters, it's a kind of defiling that mosque. It's a kind of giving disrespect or not respecting the mosque. And the position is the same with men who are in the state of janaba, or men who are in the state of ritual impurity. It's also not permissible for a minister, for a man or for a woman who is in the state of janaba to stay or to pause inside a mosque. And of course, the mosques are different from in terms of sanctity, in terms of respect. There are some very important mosques like Kufa Mosque, Masjid Sahla, and of course Masjid Buratha in Iraq. These are some well-known mosques, okay?
Yes.
Of course, we have also central mosque, we have also local mosque. The amount of reward given to a person offering prayer in these mosques differ. And also it differs, the sawab that is given to a person differs depending on the number of people who attend the prayers, the congregational prayers in these mosques.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Almost a third of Republicans believe violence may be necessary to solve the problems the United States is facing today, according to a new national survey. The poll by the nonprofit Public Religion Research Institute released recently finds that 30% of Republicans agree with the statement because things have gotten so far off track. True American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country, unquote. The findings are reflective of the continued impact of the post-presidential election events that fueled the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Adam Gavitt, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Almost 1 in 3 of Republicans Say Violence May Be Necessary to Save the U.S. Stay tuned for more. Troubling statistics show the post-election rancor that led to the U.S. Capitol attack on January 6th is still very much in place. Almost a third of Republicans believe violence may be necessary to save the U.S., according to a new poll. Researchers at the Public Religion Research Institute, a nonprofit, found that 30% of Republicans agreed with the statement because things have gotten so far off track. True American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country, unquote. Among Americans who believe the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump, 39% believe violence may be required. Troubling statistics show the post-election rancor that led to the violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th is still very much in place. Republicans are most likely to believe true American patriots may have to resort to violence, PRRI found, with just 11% of Democrats and 17% of independents agreeing with the statement. Among all Americans, 18% agreed. PRRI said 2,508 adults living in all 50 states were interviewed for the survey between 16th and 29th of September. It is an alarming finding, Robert Jones, chief executive and founder of PRRI, told Yahoo News, adding, "I have been doing this a while, for decades, and it's not the kind of finding that a sociologist, a public opinion poster that you're used to seeing." Jones said the responses illustrate the significant and rapidly increasing polarization in the United States. Jones said, "As we have gotten some distance from the January 6th attacks, one might hope cooler heads would prevail, but we really haven't seen that. If anything, it looks like people are doubling down and views are getting kind of locked in." The PRRI poll is not the first to discover an apparent readiness for violence among Republican voters. In February, a survey by the American Enterprise Institute found that 39% of Republicans thought that if elected leaders will not protect America, the people must do it themselves, even if it requires violent actions. Among all Americans, 29% agreed with that statement. Some, 31% of independent voters and 17% of Democrats, thought violent action might be required. More than 650 people have been criminally charged for their role in the Capitol attack, in which 5 people died. Trump is resisting attempts to investigate from a House Select Committee, most recently suing the National Archives to stop the release of White House documents.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the World War II was dragging on, the United States tested the first ever nuclear bomb in a desert in New Mexico on July 16, 1945. The test, codenamed Trinity, plunged humanity into the so-called atomic age. The U.S. holds another record as well. They are the first nation to ever use an atomic weapon in combat. On August 6, 1945, the U.S. dropped the world's first deployed atomic bomb over the Japanese city of Hiroshima. The explosion instantly killed an estimated 80,000 people, while tens of thousands lost their lives later due to the radiation exposure. 3 days later, a second atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, killing an estimated 40,000 people there. In fact, the U.S. is the only country in history to have cold-bloodedly used this particular sort of weapon of mass destruction ever. Not once, but twice. The world's nuclear-armed states possess a combined total of approximately 13,000 nuclear warheads. The U.S., along with Russia, own over 90% of the world's total nuclear arsenal. Washington and Moscow signed the Non-Proliferation Agreement of New START on 8th of April 2010 in Prague, and later extended it for 5 years in January 2021. The treaty caps each country at 1,550 strategic deployed warheads. Today, the United States deploys over 1,300 strategic warheads on several hundred bombers and missiles. It is also estimated to have approximately 3,800 stockpiled warheads and 1,750 retired warheads awaiting dismantlement, for a total of 5,550 warheads as of early 2021. While Washington may have reduced its nuclear arsenal in size, in fact, it's increasing the destructiveness of its weapons by development of sophisticated electronic sensors and fuses at the cost of billions of dollars to have more advanced nuclear warheads. The U.S. has time and again stated that it is committed to the New START Treaty until Russia is. However, it seems Washington is not completely committed to the agreement. On one hand, it is reducing the number of its nuclear warheads. On the other, it produces more lethal, destructive bombs with higher precision. The U.S. is expected to release its latest nuclear posture review by the end of this year. U.S. allies are concerned over a proposed change to Washington's long-standing policy on using nuclear weapons. The U.S. is reportedly considering putting a limit on the use of nuclear weapons, such as announcing a no first use of nuclear weapons or declaration of a sole purpose. That means Washington will only use nuclear weapons to respond to nuclear attacks. Hence, The U.S. allies, including the U.K., Germany, France, Japan, and Australia, are reportedly lobbying the Joe Biden administration to not to abandon the policy of a strategic ambiguity on using nuclear weapons. They believe this decision will make them more prone to possible threats from China and Russia. Obviously, this shows the anti-nuclear doctrine the U.S. allies have been advocating is totally deceitful. They are simply pursuing unilateral nuclear security as they want to expand their own right to use nuclear weapons, but they have tried every possible means to take away the right of using nuclear power from other countries, such as Iran. Restrictions on using nuclear weapons create constructive opportunities for global security. But does Biden have the courage to take real steps to do so? The group was formed to address major issues related to global economy. It is composed of world's largest economies, including Brazil, Britain, China, Germany, India, and the US, among others. These member countries account for 80% of the global GDP, 75% of global trade, and 60% of the world population. But the G20 has been criticized for its limited membership, particularly for its underrepresentation of African countries. There are also disputes over the legitimacy of the G20 and criticisms of its organization and its declarations. The group has failed to address its previous promises like inequality, social justice, poverty, capitalism, and unemployment. Therefore, the summits are often met with protests, especially by anti-globalization groups. This year, the G20 annual summit gathered the international leaders of world's biggest economies for a two-day meeting under the chairmanship of Italy in Rome. The summit was the first in-person meeting in over a year after the 2020 summit was virtual due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Still, Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin participated in the summit virtually. The member states addressed several global challenges, such as the pandemic, climate change, spiking energy prices, supply chain disruptions, and so forth. The bloc is under pressure to make headway on tackling global warming. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned G20 leaders to show more action to overcome mistrust to advance climate goals. These nations account for roughly 80% of the global greenhouse gas emissions. This year's event comes amid protests at inaction to address the problem of climate change. On Friday, thousands of school students staged a rally calling on the G20 summit to deal with the crisis. Other groups, including the charity Oxfam, also held a flash mob in Rome. They demanded world leaders end global inequality of access to coronavirus vaccines and treatment. In fact, wealthy nations such as the US have implemented a Me First policy by stockpiling vaccine doses and offering booster shots, while many poor countries are still waiting to receive their first COVID jabs.
Well, they have failed to end inequality, to end poverty, and to slow and change the trajectory of climate change, because the leaders of these governments simply don't care about those things.
After Washington imposed fresh sanctions against Iran, the United States and the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal have urged Iran to return to the talks soon to avoid what they call a dangerous escalation. In a joint statement following the G20 summit, U.S. President Joe Biden, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson have called on Iran to, quote, change course. That's a reference to Iran's remedial moves on its nuclear commitments. Tehran stood by its obligations for a whole year, but it started cutting back on them in response to the U.S. abandonment of the deal in 2018 and the failure of the European parties to keep their side of the agreement. Iran says it's ready to restart negotiations in late November, but wants to see the verifiable removal of sanctions as an outcome of the talks. Washington, on the other hand, targeted Tehran's drone program with a new set of sanctions on Friday, a move which Iran says is at odds with the White House claims of wishing to rejoin the agreement.
They will justify it by saying that Iran wouldn't come back to the bargaining table. They will not look at the fact that it was the United States that withdrew, and the United States that must make the first major moves to resurrect this agreement. But this summit is certainly a place where many, many discussions occur, many issues are on the table to be resolved. The situation with U.S. violations of JCPOA is certainly one of them, but it is being ignored.
Iran has been under the most intense scrutiny and inspection by the IAEA than any country in the world. Meanwhile, Tehran has time and again stated that its nuclear program is peaceful and it was among the first nations to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Tehran's stance is clear: effective removal of anti-Iran sanctions and the normalization of economic and trade ties with the country. Iran requires guarantees that the other parties to the 2015 nuclear deal will not break their promises once again.
Sudan's transition to democracy has been disrupted by yet another coup. Last week, head of Sudan's ruling council, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, announced a dissolution of the country's transitional government and declared a state of emergency. He cited political infighting for the decision, adding that the move was made to avoid a civil war. The military rounded up Sudan's top officials, including Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok.
This government, or this government that Burhan has overthrown, was a government that came about on the basis of an agreement that there would not be any elections, that there would not be a democratic transition. It's important to stress that when al-Bashir fell, the reason why the civilian parties were happy to enter into an agreement with the army is because they felt that if they went to elections, the Sudanese people would reject them and vote for Islamic-leaning parties, i.e. vote for the Islamists in a different form from al-Bashir. And therefore, these leftist parties that are the civilian parties that Burhan has overthrown, they were happy to prevent elections. They were happy to take 67% of parliament unelected. They were happy to agree to an extended transition period in order to avoid giving people a say in what they wanted.
Nearly a dozen protesters were killed in the demonstrations that ensued, but that didn't deter the Sudanese from calling for mass protests against the coup. General Burhan has expressed hope that a new prime minister would be chosen to form a government within a week. He also suggested that the ousted prime minister has been offered a chance to return to his position and select a new cabinet. The next government is expected to stay in power until an election in 2023. The protesters say the military isn't serious about handing over power to civilians, describing the council as an extension of the old regime. The coup in Sudan drew condemnation from the international community, with the United Nations Security Council adopting a unanimous declaration calling on the junta to restore the civilian government. The World Bank has halted financial aid to the African country, while the African Union suspended Sudan's membership in the bloc. Iran has also denounced the coup, saying the undemocratic removal of a part of the ruling system in the African country disregards the demands of the Sudanese people. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Said Khatibzadeh, raised the possibility of foreign interference in what led to the ouster of Sudan's civilian rulers. He referred to reactions from Israel, where he said some are openly expressing delight in the aftermath of the recent coup.
That doesn't come as a surprise, as Sudan normalized ties with the regime last year under an agreement brokered by the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Sudan's top brass have also maintained good relationships with the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, but experts believe that seemingly close ties might not last long.
It's important to remember that the UAE are also allies with the leftist parties in Sudan. The UAE was part of brokering the agreement between the leftist parties and the army, and also the UAE is hesitant with regards to the army that Abdel Fattah Burhan leads, in that even if it is perhaps comfortable with Abdel Fattah Burhan, the army is still seen to be predominantly Islamist, the army is still seen to be predominantly conservative, the army is still predominantly against normalization of ties with Israel. Even if Abdel Fattah Burhan himself has been pushing normalization of ties with Israel, there is a worry in the UAE and in Egypt that if the army becomes stronger in Sudan once more, then Abdel Fattah Burhan will not last long, and it may well be that they go back to the more conservative trends that al-Bashir represented. And this is why it's important to stress that it is not a given that the UAE, Saudi, and Egypt will support this coup. It's not a given that they are lobbying on behalf of Abdel Fattah Burhan.
But it appears that the Sudanese are determined to continue their protests, as they have done in the past few years, until their demands are met.
Saudi Arabia and its ally, the United Arab Emirates, have been defying international calls for an end to their disastrous war in Yemen. The destructive military campaign that's triggered the world's worst humanitarian crisis has been ongoing since March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, most of them civilians, have been killed in airstrikes or by deadly diseases or hunger. Millions have been displaced. Yemen's economy is in tatters, and international aid can hardly make its way to those in severe need because of a Saudi blockade. Despite untold human suffering, Saudis and Emiratis keep pounding Yemen in a war that has achieved none of its stated goals. And the aggressors are absolutely intolerant of any form of criticism of what they are doing in Yemen. That was on full display this week as criticism of the devastating war by a Lebanese minister infuriated the kingdom and its allies, triggering angry reactions from them. Saudi Arabia and most members of the Saudi-led Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, namely the UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait, summoned Lebanese ambassadors to their capitals. This after Lebanese Information Minister George Khordai called for an end to the futile military campaign against Yemen. The Saudi Foreign Ministry said in a statement that it handed the ambassador a memorandum protesting against the minister's, quote, offensive remarks.
They know they're in the wrong. They feel guilty. And they also feel a sense of impunity. They feel that no one should criticize them because they've got lots of money and other people don't. So, you know, it's a very sensitive subject for them. What they're doing in Yemen is... If any other country had done it, they would have been condemned much more fiercely and much sooner by the other countries in the region and the world. But the Saudis think that they have a lock on the Arab world and the Islamic world and much of the Western world, so they really don't understand criticism.
The Lebanese information minister said in the interview that the Saudi-led forces are pounding homes, villages, funerals, and weddings. Khordai also said that he believes that the popular Ansar Allah forces are defending themselves against an external aggression. The Lebanese information minister is now finding himself at the center of a political storm for speaking his mind. This is because Lebanon has been trying to improve ties with Persian Gulf Arab states. Prime Minister Najib Mikati seems to be in damage control mode now. He said the interview was recorded before his cabinet was formed and was a personal opinion rather than official policy. The information minister, who is under pressure for his remarks against the devastating war in Yemen, says he stated his position with love as a human who feels Arab suffering. The humanitarian situation in Yemen is apocalyptic. The unbearable suffering of civilians in Yemen has been ongoing for several years. But no measure has been taken against the war, which has also been militarily backed by Western allies of Saudi Arabia. The war in Yemen had been planned to quickly achieve its goals, like reinstating former President Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, who was a Saudi ally. But it has proved to be an embarrassing failure. Despite this, the invaders remain defiant and are not changing course. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Faced with international inaction, the Yemenis have been left with no other option than retaliatory missile and drone attacks against Saudi targets.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Mujtahidi Tehrani. Stay tuned.
امام چهارم ارسال فرمود اگر شمر بیاد پیش من اون شمشیری که با او شمشیر سر پدر منو با او شمشیر برید پیش من امانت بذاره.
The fourth infallible Imam As-Sajjad states, if Shimr, who killed my father at Karbala, comes to me and gives his sword in trust to me, I mean the same sword that beheaded my father, and then one day comes back and asks for his trust, that sword, I will give it back to him. This sentence of Imam As-Sajjad shows how important it is to safeguard one's trust or to return the property of someone which is in your hands. Please pay attention. If somebody gives you an amount of money to keep it as a trust by yourself, but all of a sudden he passes away, you must give his trust to his inheritors after his demise.
ادای امانت به شما یه پولی داده گفته این پیشت امانت باشه باید اگر مرد بری به ورثش بدی ادای امانت کنی.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was an English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Mujtahidi Tehrani. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
Legends never die. So 1 year after his death, Argentinians are remembering their hero on his birthday. And that's no one but that legendary football player, Diego Maradona. It would have been Maradona's 61st birthday this year. People all around the country, including in the capital, Buenos Aires, remembered their iconic figure in ceremonies over the weekend. In the city of Rosario, a giant monument was inaugurated in honor of the football star. You can see on your screens fans gathering there in celebration. They say Maradona's love still runs in the veins of Argentinians. Amsterdam, the capital of the Netherlands, is riddled with waterways through which thousands of boats pass each day. Soon, the city may also be hosting self-driving vessels. Amsterdam's Institute for Advanced Metropolitan Solutions has devised an autonomous boat that can cross the city's busy canals without the help of a conductor. The watercraft, named a rowboat, is the size of a small car. The developers intend to use the boats for tasks ranging from transporting people to collecting trash. They think it can also be used for less conventional purposes, like preventing oil spills or forming a temporary bridge. Amsterdam's authorities are considering locations for a trash collection pilot project starting early next year. One of the disastrous effects of climate change has been the loss of glaciers worldwide. People around the world are trying new ways to tackle this problem. Now, a team of Chilean conservationists have come up with a creative project to protect glaciers and prevent water loss. The project is called Nilus. Winter rains are collected in cone-like structures called stupas. Experts from Chile are using a technology that was first developed in India to make these man-made glaciers. The water is then later used in the dry summer months. Chile has been experiencing a severe drought for years. Nilus director Enrique Gilona says the project hopes to address water shortages in the country.
Here we are not creating new water. Water is something that is in nature already. It has a cycle, but clearly it has been affected by the effects of the great climate change, which we are facing. And we are looking for a solution that actually allows us to protect this water for a longer time in the mountain range, to be able to deliver it downstream toward the communities.
The goal is to store some 100 million liters of water across 50 stupas next year. This would be enough water to supply 100,000 people for 3 months. The first prototype was erected in park arenas, an area known for its glaciers surrounding the volcano, the highest parts of the mountain region. Researchers and activists have warned that glaciers in the Andes Mountains have been receding in recent years. They blame climate change for the loss of glaciers and water shortages. A photo on social media, an art article or a TV program can all draw attention to climate change. But to a German artist, nothing seems to be as effective as a journey using a giant wire ball to make his voice heard. Arndt Drossel started his journey from his hometown Paderborn, West Germany, 3 months ago. The trip has so far taken him through more than 60 cities. He has completed a journey to the Scottish city of Glasgow, the venue of a major UN climate conference. Drossel says he aims to tell people how they can help tackle climate change, now a key global problem. The German artist believes everyone has a duty to solve the problem to help next generations have a good future.
My wife and we have 5 children, and we want to give them a good and happy future. And everybody knows, I think, about the problems our Earth has, and we will have the same problem in several cities and countries.
The German artist says he has encouraged people to make specific promises to tackle climate change. He says his own pledge was to offset all his personal carbon emissions by using the sphere for his journey. Drossel says he will continue his efforts until the promises reach a million. Meet Clarion, a homemade polar bear whose mission is to raise awareness of climate change in a 500-kilometer pilgrimage to Glasgow. The 3-meter polar bear is work of British furniture maker Bamber Hoss. The bear weighs 17 kilograms and is made of bamboo, willow, and tissue paper. Hoss started his journey with Clarion from his hometown of Bishop's Castle in England to Glasgow. They accomplished their spectacular journey ahead of the United Nations COP26 climate conference in the Scottish city. Hoss says Clarion is a symbol of melting Arctic ice caps due to global warming.
He's called Clarion. Clarion the bear is not a bear. He is a metaphor. He's a symbol. It is a very obvious symbol that a polar bear represents the Arctic, not the Antarctic, and that is where, you know, some of the problems are with melting ice caps. Not all the problems, because they're elsewhere as well.
Hoss says his aim is to encourage people to pay attention to climate change. Environmental activists from across the UK and elsewhere on the continent have also embarked on a long journey on foot to reach the UN climate change conference in Glasgow. Did you know that animals might have the potential to help tackle climate change? Strange indeed, but that seems to be the case according to scientists. The sheep on a remote Scottish island have a special diet that consists mainly of seaweed. This feature is what scientists are hoping can help reduce global warming. Sheep usually feed on grass, and the process contributes to methane emissions. But scientists say the sheep in Orkneys are unique because they are because of spending the winter eating only the marine plants. Listen to one researcher explaining whether feeding seaweed into the sheep diet can actually help reduce gas emissions.
The main thing at the moment is we need to absolutely prove, one, which seaweed is going to be the best for this, what amount of seaweed into the feed gives the best effect, and then can you scale that up to a level where you would actually have an effect on the overall UK farming?
If proven, the Scottish sheep and their unique diet could lead to a breakthrough in methods for livestock breeding, which is a major source of greenhouse gases. Methane is about 30 times more powerful than carbon dioxide in trapping heat in the atmosphere.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Flocks of sheep are on the streets of Madrid. The animals have made their way through the center of the Spanish capital to follow ancient migration routes. Shepherds accompanied their sheep and goats moving through the streets of the Spanish capital. It actually marks a centuries-old annual tradition that began in 1994. The event allows shepherds to migrate their cattle from summer to winter pastures. They do so based on a deal struck in 1418 that allows the animals to walk through the city freely. The event attracts hundreds of people. It was canceled last year due to the pandemic, but this year, many locals came out to watch.
The Philippines is among the countries facing a soaring plastic waste crisis. However, a group of recyclers are working hard to tackle the problem, turning the waste into building materials. The group is called the Plastic Flamingo, or simply the PLAF. They gather bottles, single-use sachets, and snack food wrappers. The waste is then shredded and molded into post-ad planks that can be used for decking and fencing. Their products are also durable enough to make disaster relief shelters and urban furniture. The group says the coronavirus pandemic has worsened the plastic waste problem, sparking a rush for protection equipment. Their disposal is a matter of concern now.
Because of the plastic problem we're currently facing, the pandemic, the huge accumulation of plastic use, there's also improper disposal. People are unaware on, you know, how do I dispose these plastics? Where do I dispose of them? So at the same time, we give that avenue also that instead of putting it in landfills or oceans in general, you know, you give it to the PLAF, you give it to recycling centers like us, and we would recycle these, upcycle them into better products.
The PLAF says surging online shopping is also another problem that they try to address. The group has collected over 100 tons of plastic waste since it started the business in 2019. However, they still have a lot to do. A UN report says some 300 million tons of plastic waste are produced annually, with South Asian countries accounting for 60% of it. North Macedonian Zoo has a new inhabitant. It may be small, but it has certainly sparked a big amount of joy. The baby marmoset was born 3 weeks ago. Its parents are super protective of their precious offspring. That's why zoo staff have not been able to get close to the baby and determine if it's a male or a female. The tiny primate will be given a name after its sex is known. Marmosets are the world's smallest monkeys. On average, they are about 13 centimeters long and weigh up to 100 grams. The adorable animals can be found in a number of countries in the Americas.
The hustle and bustle of modern life has made it difficult to communicate with nature the way humans used to do a few decades ago. Now a giant statue in the state of New York reminds us of the importance of lending an attentive ear to our surroundings. The massive statue named Water's Soul is located along the Hudson River. A woman's head with her index finger pressing on her lips seems she's asking bystanders to maintain silence. It's a work of 66-year-old Spanish artist Juanme Palenza. He says the message of his work is, quote, to call on people to listen to the profound noise of the water talking to us. Water's Soul was made of polyester resin, fiberglass, and marble dust at a Barcelona studio. It was later shipped to its Jersey City site for assembly. The The sculpture is 24 meters tall.
You might have heard of Iran's stellar wrestling achievements or about its soccer team, but that's not all. Another sport has grabbed attention too. Golfers now competing during Iran's national golf tournament in Tehran. This year, 90 participants from around the country played on a very unique golf course. It is only 13 holes instead of the standard 18, but that hasn't stopped golf enthusiasts playing the 13 holes and then repeating the last five to complete the tournament. The good news is that the golf course might not stay so small for long. Iran's Golf Federation hopes to bring in more people interested in golf. But for this to happen, the infrastructure must be provided first.
We don't have the space to use the 350 instructors to train the 3,000 registered men and women across the country, so we decided to build a national academy off the golf course. Course number 18 will be used in a competition venue during tournaments and as a training and education venue during non-competition times.
When the course was built decades ago in northern Tehran, it had five more holes. But over the years, fairways were laid across parts of the field, reducing playable footprint. Tehran's golf club has about 300 members, half are women. Golf has been around in Iran for over a century, and most of the courses are in southern provinces. Concerned about endangered animals? If yes, then it will be good news that a Mexican zoo has welcomed a newborn zebra. It belongs to the most threatened of the three species of zebra in the world. The foal made a public appearance Thursday, 10 days after it was born at a zoo in northern Mexico. It's about 50 centimeters tall. Its weight, between 10 to 15 kilograms. The newborn equine raises hopes for the conservation of the imperial zebra species.
We are the only zoo in Mexico that has this species of zebra. Unfortunately, it is an endangered species. Here at the zoo, we are doing everything possible to preserve and produce them so that in the future, we can repopulate some other parks.
The imperial zebra is native to Africa. It is the largest of the wild equids, the family of horses, donkeys, and other animals. Currently, there are less than 2,500 of imperial zebras in the wild. That's blamed on the destruction of their habitat, illegal hunting, and lack of food.
IRIB English Radio.